Hey, it's Michael Silverblatt, host of Bookworm, produced at nonprofit KCRW. We're going to start right away, don't worry. But before we do, I want to ask you for your support. Why? Because you like us. We've made it really easy for you to hear a conversation that you'd never hear anywhere else. Text KCRW to 20222 and send us $10. That's all it takes. All right, let's start the show. Thanks.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinbergen? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my great pleasure and honor to talk to Will Self about his new book, Umbrella, a book that attempts to bring us to an awareness of how complex literature can be, and it can be complex because life is complex. And life can be misinterpreted, so can literature, so can people. This is a book about perception and misinterpretation and memory and loss. And as a result, it begins, I think, with an immediate joke in its title, Umbrella, because there is a very famous three-syllable book in the English language whose title begins with a U, and that is, of course, Ulysses. And this book is meant to hold up Ulysses as a kind of standard for what literature could have become if only we'd looked at it carefully enough to see that Ulysses is itself a book of the tics and phonological devices that came about as a result of mechanized culture, and in particular of World War I, that Joyce was reporting, using every device at his disposal, a new way of living, moving, thinking, being. But we called it a literary book instead of a realistic book. And in a sense, we lost it by not understanding what Joyce was up to, which is and was to define the modern age.
Yes, I think he registered, it's Marshall McLuhan who says the artist registers the impact of new technologies well in advance of the rest of society. I think he played a joke on critical estimation, of course, by back-setting it by 10 years, but it was written during the First War. There's that marvellous line in Tom Stoppard's play Travesties where the character asks the Jimmy Joyce character in it, set in Zurich, says, what have you done during the war, Mr. Joyce? And he says, I've been writing Ulysses. And that's, Stoppard clearly gets it, that it is a response to that period.
In a fell swoop, we entered a realm of psychotic spasm that was to shape all life after.
Right. I mean, it seems to me, in as much as the novel is a response to Ulysses and plays off that, I'm always at pains to stress that the intertextual elements were by no means uppermost in my composition of it. There were emotional things, and there were awarenesses that were my own in relation to that period, which had begun to interest me very much, and particularly in relation to London, where I live and have lived all my life. London in many ways the pivotal scene in the novel is in fact one where Audrey's father, this rather grandiloquent bus garage manager, so a sort of blue collar man, takes her up to the West End of London in 1903. And what I was at pains to try and convey was the absolute modernity of the city, that in fact They are existing in a completely liminal moment, one in which a pre-industrial sensibility, or at any rate pre-technological sensibility, is encountering the integrated spectacle of the modern city.
Yes, this is what I, for some reason, have chosen to call the book's double writing. Because on the one hand, a father, known hilariously as Rothschild Death, kind of Dickensian name, but in a city full of distrust of Jews and distrust of the wealthy and distrust of the poor and distrust of one another, this Dickensian city is in fact a place of great darkness and secrecy and deals that the young girl, in what should have been a sweet scene holding Daddy's hand to go and see the city through Daddy's eyes, instead encounters the darkness of the modern city. We see it both ways. We know what the scene is supposed to have been, and we also see what London has already become.
Well, I think your trope is very exact, and I haven't thought about, because it's not my business to do the fine work of a critic in relation to my own text. That would be a big mistake, but you're absolutely right.
She ends up in an asylum and is there when we see her for over 40 years. And she is incapable of speech. She's been classified as insane. And now we're going to see, 40 years on, what this war has done. In other words, what James Joyce knew when he wrote Ulysses, we're going to see the dire consequences of in the insane asylum, because in this book, the world is being read as asylumable, insane, derelict, lost, mechanical, broken. And it's a really dark, but hellish, but brilliant vision of a whole society that no longer knows how to define sanity.
Well, yes, all of that is undoubtedly going on. I mean, the long-standing preoccupation I have with the socially and culturally relative nature of psychopathology, I think, reaches a kind of crescendo, actually, in this novel.
Well, I think, really, I've been reading you for quite some time. I think you've become a quite different kind of writer. And I think that the intensity and sensitivity that, whereas before there were acts of derision and alienation, that this book is built out of a constant array of empathetic imagination. It may be describing hell, but it's an attempt to understand how we got there.
Well, I think one of the things that I think people talk a lot of nonsense about, the use of the prime modernist techniques of the deployment of continuous present and whatever you call it, stream of consciousness or free and direct, or because you modulate between them or monopolize narration. What they do for me is liberate me from the strictures of cod Freudian depth psychology, which is the established naturalistic paradigm for understanding character. And my problem with character, and why I've been unable to approach it without a degree of sort of antic satire or derision or nihilism, is because I felt under pressure to supply a similar cod psychology. And what being in my characters allows me to do, which is what I can do in the continuous present, what I can do with stream of consciousness, is that I can present people as I believe people are, which is not influenced by these paradigms, which are actually a projection by and large.
But from the inside.
Yes, responding to the Heraclitean flux of experience, which is what I think we're mostly like.
A good deal of Will Self's umbrella concerns a doctor and one of his patients. The doctor's name is?
Zach Buzner.
And the patient is?
Audrey Death.
And Audrey has been in a mental institution, although it's not clear that she has a mental disease, for over 40 years.
Yeah.
And Dr. Busner has the intuition that something else is going on. And he brings her through the administration of a drug to speak. And I was kind of dazzled by the scene because I came to realize afterwards that it's anything but what you'd expect. This is Will Self reading from Umbrella.
"More tea, Miss Dearth?" Busner asks. The old woman, lady, has an erect bearing sitting straight up in bed. She speaks with a peculiar accent as well. Cockney, elocuted to death. "No," she says, "I think not, Dr. Busner. But may I ask..." They dangle on her every clipped vowel, brown suede and black leather kicking in the dense atmosphere of the summertime ward. "Why it is that you refer to me as Miss Dearth when my given name is Death, D-E-A-T-H, precisely so. I can conceive that such a name may seem not fit for a hospital, not encouraging. There've been times, I admit, when I've given ground to common superstition and styled myself De'ath. But, so far as I'm aware, all my official documentation at the Labour Exchange and such like, census forms and so forth, will have me registered as Death. Audrey." Busner and Maboya exchange looks. They hear what she says. They listen, amazed, to the way she is saying it. Her small, sharp chin is no longer digging into her sternum. Her eyes are neither transfixed nor anomalously mobile in a mask-like face. Indeed, face and eyes synchronize together in the subtle interplay of normal expressiveness. Gone are the puckering, pursing, and pouting of the Parkinsonian mouth, its compulsive grimacing, its incessant chewing. "Dr. Busner, I am not a fool, and nor have I been in a complete swoon these past years. If you wish to form some idea of the constitution of my mind, it may well aid you to think of me as a sort of soldier, but recently returned from the front and afflicted with a very peculiar sense of shell shock." Busner is caught and held. He realizes by the Selenian serenity of her features. It's a shocker. She is a beautiful woman, and presumably always has been. Turned at last from the darkness, she shines with self-possessed awareness of her own sex appeal. "Will you ask the blackie to fetch me my dressing gown?" He looks to see how Maboya is taking it, but the charge nurse, whose long legs are casually crossed, only smiles sardonically and jiggles one foot so that it throws back its flared cowl. "You do understand," Busner says, "the situation, what year it is, how long you've been here." She composes herself before she replies, interleaving her fingers and arranging her laced-up hands on the turned-back sheet. He watches this intently, alive to her tremor. Is it increasing in amplitude, in frequency? She folds her crimpline throat and says, "Ahem! The situation, as you term it, Dr. Busner, is indeed quite extraordinary. But bear in mind that for me it has been quite extraordinary for a very long time. If this specific or paregoric or whatever it is you've dosed me with, what you call it, by the by?" He says, "L-Dopa." She says, "L-Dopa, eh? Well, if this L-Dopa stuff continues to do its bit, then perhaps I will have the opportunity to tell you quite how extraordinary it has been for me. However, now is not the time, nor can we sit here all day twiddling our thumbs."
Now, what dazzled me here, we've been waiting. This occurs around halfway through the book. We've been waiting to hear her voice. We expect something frail, something fragile, but what we get is the scene between Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle when she's gone to Ascot and has yelled out, "Move your blooming arse," to the society people. She's a witty woman. She's capable of rapidly taking in a transfer because she has been, in fact, conscious. She isn't Rip Van Winkle. She's been awake and alert all this time, just not communicating. And so the scene becomes kind of Shavian. These are these men who classically dominate and dandle women for very basic perception of who, what, and where they are.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think, and I think you're right also to pick up on the Shavian overtones that I hadn't considered. I mean, it's always interesting, and I think that, you know, one's psyche becomes a test bed for these ideas. And of course, I was exposed to a lot of Shaw. My father was a big Shavian, so we had Shaw was much bruited about in the childhood home. And I think that's almost undoubtedly where that scene comes from. And it's a straightforward comic reversal. That's right.
I think the novel, what I'd call it, is double writing. And so we get scenes that we expect we know. For instance, a golf scene. But it turns out to be written as if it were a battlefield scene. And because of this double writing, what we're given to see, although it may not literally be so, this golf course might as well be the golf course on the hospital grounds, that we're folding time and space so that we see that the lunatic asylum is the context for all of these transformations. This is where rich and poor are changing places. This is where intellectuals are being transformed into dummies. This is where mental patients are being identified as insane rather than having Parkinson's disease, a physical ailment. That the book is a thrilling language adventure that shows us how language can be used to frame perception in such a way that what we think we see may not be what's there.
Yes, I mean, the mental hospital in which, I mean, and this was the real fate of people who fell victim to this encephalitis lethargica epidemic that was a bizarre sort of prequel to the Spanish flu epidemic, which is more widely remembered. They ended up often being diagnosed with what was then still called general paralysis of the insane and ending up in long-term mental institutions, whereas, of course, they were had a physical illness. But I suppose, you know, lurking there is the idea of these long-term institutions, which were of course existed here in the USA in the form of state hospitals as well, and in the UK, were kind of synecdoches of the wider culture, that they existed in counterpoise to what was going on in the wider culture. They were so large and so various when they were founded in the mid-19th century. They were often quite enlightened, but they became in due course a sort of test bed for all of these kind of social and manipulative theories.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Will Self about his book, Umbrella. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Will Self about his new book, Umbrella, the story of a misdiagnosed catatonic woman, her doctor, and the story he manages to unlock. Now, I would like to propose, I hear that Umbrella is in fact the first book of a trilogy.
Mm.
Is that the case?
That is the case, yes. I don't know why I'm laughing, but I think because of I'm laughing at that, the sort of worrying audacity of my project.
Well, I think it's thrilling because I think, in a sense, you really wanted Umbrella to be a first book. Maybe not the first book of your career, but to be a reinauguration?
Yes, I think it probably is. Though I think there is, you know, as people say about, you know, Karl Marx, there is an epistemological break there. But it's not as profound in some ways as one might imagine. And looking back, because I think that the book before Walking to Hollywood was actually a book about a writer who had reached the end of his fidelity to the way he'd been writing before. It is a book about struggling to reinvent oneself as a writer. And if we look to the sort of major novel before that, or the big novel, the Book of Dave, that also is at the beginnings of an attempt. It's got much more monopolized narration in it. It's got much more, phoneticization of the demotic. And it's got, you know, so it's starting to get that way. There's something going on. But Umbrella is a definitive break. There's no question. It's not satire, for a start, which is what always got flung at me.
And it really does show something that I hadn't recognized before, that you have a really good ear for speech and for the sound of things and for the smell of things.
Well, it's nice of you to pick on the smell. I actually write on my typescripts. I always have to write smell on the first draft to remember to put smells in, because I, in fact, I I'm colorblind as well, so I have to remind myself to. I'm quite badly colorblind, so in order to remember that other people see quite vivid colors.
You know, life takes you by the neck and says, you know, change or die. And that's, you had developed a reputation as a satirist junkie. And this book is in a wonderland. I don't know what the rabbit hole was, but you were taken elsewhere.
There were other narratives, again, that, I mean, I'm not going to write off all the early funny books. There's another transitional narrative that I don't think was much, you know, came above the critical wire, which was a novella-length story called Leberknödel from the collection Liver, which was about a transformation, and it has a lot of doubleness in it, about a woman with terminal cancer going for an assisted dying in Switzerland, who then spontaneously recovers from her illness. And that was me groping towards a new idiom, a new approach as well, I think. And then,
of course it's not black and white, and of course changes don't occur overnight. We would like them to. We would like there to be just a simple, well, it's following the white rabbit down into Wonderland. But no, writing is a gradual thing. But this surprised me. I didn't expect to be fully engaged at this demanding and exciting a level, both by concrete detail and by theoretical perception, and by what amounts to, by the time you're finished, a whole revelation of two different families that now revealed can be left behind like a broken umbrella. What was it all for? You know, or as Donald Barthelme once said, wonderful understanding, no use at all.
One hesitates. I don't think it matters. I think I'm allowed to conceive of what I'm doing with my oeuvre overall, how the hell I please. And the fact of the matter is that I've always understood the narratives to interlock. I've always been interested in the idea that if fiction can do anything for us, it's not by its correspondence with the external world, the sort of Stendhalian idea that art is the mirror of life, but it's by its internal coherence, which is why, even from my first collection, the Quantity Theory of Insanity, narratives interlock, characters recur, ideas recur, is because I was always trying to build up this coherence theory of presenting truth. So Busner, as a character that has persisted from my first book and now, as it were, efflorescens psychically in Umbrella. We enter his consciousness, whereas heretofore he's only been a kind of hieratic figure. He's been somebody we see almost in profile, like a sort of Assyrian god king. Getting to know him in that way has been, you know, essential to Umbrella. You know, so you don't want to say to a reader, "Oh, you've actually got to read sort of 14 other works of fiction in order to really understand what's going on here," because of course the book does stand alone. But at the same time, for people who have, as it were, the many backstories, it's a different thing. You know,
it's something I love, but I doubt that prior to this, you would have described the ongoing body of your work as a quest for coherence. But I think, you know, there's something that we lost as human beings. I used to read books all the time called Man's Search for Meaning. And meaningfulness and coherence, even as mythical values, seem to me to be so important and so valuable that while I wouldn't say that you're turning in an optimistic direction, you are allowing something other than nihilism, a coherence.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think I really, with How the Dead Live, in which I must have published in about 2001 or two, I started to set my back to nihilism. But nihilism is very powerful. It's a very, very, it's philosophically powerful. It's in sensory terms, it's so astringent, you know, that it kind of, it's very difficult to wean oneself off it because it's so powerfully alerts you. It's a kind of, it's what Albert Dath would call an adjuvant.
And it's seductive.
Yeah.
It's really cooler than anything
else. It's cooler. It's black skinny jeans. It's, you know, it's everything. It's Juliet Greco, you know. And you know, it's got the best tunes in many ways. And there's a sense in which it outguesses one's capacity to write it off as attitudinizing. It says, well, right, you condemn this as attitudinizing. Look at your attitude. You know, it flings it right back at you. And so it's taken me a full decade to modulate my way out of it, really, rather than to be able to break definitively.
I've been talking with Will Self, author most recently of Umbrella, published by Grove Press, recently made available in paperback. This was a great pleasure for me. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Umbrella at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks for guiding me through this to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Erica Jong is our guest.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.